we can catch our citizens in the early stages, and they don't have to go directly into a hardcore punitive corrections system.
A new tribal court restorative justice agreement with the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the challenge of budget cuts and educating kids.
We are not going to be less of a school district because of this crisis. We are going to push through the crisis and continue to focus on kids.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The state of Alaska and the Anvik tribe have signed an historic justice agreement. The government-to-government PAC provides a template for tribal courts to administer restorative sentences in certain lower-level cases as an alternative to the state criminal justice system. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Western Interior Anvik Tribe is the first of several across the state expected to sign on to the justice agreement. It allows willing offenders, both tribal and non-tribal, to divert from state to a tribal court for lower-level and first-time crimes, including domestic violence, alcohol, and drug offenses. Alaska Attorney General Jonna Lindemuth announced the agreement during a Tuesday press conference in Anchorage.
In recent years, our state courts have used more restorative justice and therapeutic court models focus on treatment rather than incarceration. And I think there will be greater success when a community uses its culturally relevant restorative justice tools.
Lindemuth says the state is in contact with federal officials about funding for tribal courts, noting that the justice alternative is expected to both save the state money and bring attention to offenses the state does not have the capacity to address. Will Mayo with the Tanana Chiefs Conference called the agreement a step toward bringing justice to far reaches of the state, noting that it can stem issues before they become more serious.
So if we have restorative justice systems that can begin to emerge through an agreement like this, then we can catch our citizens in the early stages where they make a mistake, and they don't have to go directly into a hardcore punitive corrections system.
Tribally administered penalties outlined under the agreement can include fines up to $1,500 or replacement of stolen or damaged property, but also include apology to those impacted by a crime. Offenders who refuse to comply with tribal court orders face prosecution in state court. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
President-elect Donald Trump today leaned on Congress to quickly get rid of President Obama's signature health care law, which he called a catastrophe. Lisa Murkowski, though, is among five Republicans in the U.S. Senate sponsoring an amendment that would slow the law's repeal.
Trying to rush things through to a conclusion, in my mind, doesn't make sense. And I know everyone has said, repeal, repeal, repeal. We're going to repeal it. We're going to repeal it.
But the senator says Congress needs time to craft a replacement for the Affordable Care Act, and she says the repeal and replacement should coincide. Murkowski says the new Trump administration will need time, too.
You've got new people coming on deck over here. You've got your lawmakers trying to structure a framework. All this has to work together. What they're doing and what we're doing ultimately has to work together in order to knit something that's going to be good for the Alaskan constituency and the American public.
Murkowski doesn't have a specific replacement plan in hand. Some elements of the Affordable Care Act she wants to preserve, like retaining coverage for people with pre-existing conditions and allowing children to stay on their parents' policy until age 26. She says the ACA's subsidized insurance is important to a small but significant number of Alaskans, and she spoke favorably of the coverage extended to low-income households.
Medicaid expansion. Is that something you want to keep? Are you committed to keeping that?
Well, it is an absolutely a key part to this discussion, particularly as it relates to states like Alaska that have moved forward with Medicaid expansion.
But she says she wants to drop the individual mandate. Defenders of the Affordable Care Act insist the mandate is key because it ensures enough healthy people buy insurance to spread the costs around. The amendment Murkowski sponsored would extend until March, a legislative deadline for the national budget. Murkowski says that would allow enough time to draft a new plan, which she says will require Democratic votes to pass. Education funding in Governor Bill Walker's proposed budget remains relatively flat for the upcoming fiscal year. And even though big cuts to education are not yet proposed, districts are finding ways to cope with funding that doesn't necessarily keep up with yearly cost increases. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Dr. Dina Paramo, superintendent of the Anchorage School District, is counting her blessings.
We feel fortunate moving into this year that it isn't any worse.
If the governor's proposed education budget of more than $1.27 billion in unrestricted and designated general funds makes it through the Alaska legislature, ASD would receive about $330 million. And Paramo says the district is anticipating more of the same for the next few years.
We're looking at creating budgets that are scalable so that we understand exactly where every dollar goes.
While the governor has not called for education cuts next year, the near stagnant level of funding does not keep up with the district's annual increases, including the cost of living, salaries, and the replacement of books and instructional material. Jim Anderson, ASD's chief financial officer, says that will create a deficit for the district.
Right now, we predict that shortfall, if it were to operate in accordance with the governor's proposed budget, would be somewhere between $13 to $15 million. And that would be some shortfall in the transportation arena for our buses, and that would be roughly $1.5 plus million, and then the remainder would be out of general fund.
And Anderson says that shortfall comes as the district grapples with a nearly $11 million deficit produced last summer when bond debt reimbursement funding was slashed from the state budget at the 11th hour.
We have already paid down $4 million of that shortfall, and we're working with the school board for authorization to look internally to be able to fund the rest through the remainder of this year.
The remaining funds from this year are expected to come out of ASD's emergency savings account. Despite looming budget issues for both the state and the district, Superintendent Paramo remains optimistic.
When moms and dads come home and take a hit at work or some kind of reduction or furlough, they don't decide to be worse parents because they're making less money. That's ridiculous. We are not going to be less of a school district because of this crisis. We are going to push through the crisis and continue to focus on kids.
The Anchorage School Board has listed five priorities for the legislative session: the base student allocation formula, bond debt reimbursement, student transportation, the importance of maintaining pre-kindergarten programs, adequate funding, and discussing exactly what adequate means. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
An inmate at Highland Correctional Center died by suicide today. 22-year-old Nina Amigail Alexi was found unresponsive in her cell during a routine check last Friday. She was taken to Alaska Regional Hospital and passed away today. Department of Corrections spokesperson Corey Allen Young says there's no indication she was on suicide watch. Alexi was awaiting trial for murder two and manslaughter for the death of her infant daughter last summer. Her death will be investigated by the state's medical examiner's office, the state troopers, and internally by DOC. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, continued Fukushima radiation testing finds Alaska fish are clean.
Fishing is such a huge part of our lives here. There was just an overwhelming concern. They wanted to see, you know, Alaska-specific data.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If subsistence is important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local federal subsistence regional advisory council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Deadline to apply is Friday, February 3rd. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Alaska seafood remains free of detectable Fukushima-related radiation. That's according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The department, along with other state, federal, and international agencies, has been testing Alaska seafood since 2013. After the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, food safety authorities, including the FDA, reported it would be highly unlikely that radiation would affect Pacific seafood in the U.S., but there was still significant public concern in Alaska, says Marlena Brewer, the spokesperson for DEC.
Fishing is such a huge part of our lives here, so I think that there was just an overwhelming concern. They wanted to see, you know, Alaska-specific data.
Food safety inspectors were already collecting samples around Alaska as part of normal food safety operations. In 2013, they began collecting additional samples to send to the FDA lab in Massachusetts for testing for Fukushima-related radiation. Species tested include king, chum, sockeye, and pink salmon, halibut, pollock, sablefish, herring, and Pacific cod. In 2016, Alaska was selected as the first state test site for implementation of a field-deployable gamma ray analysis system to analyze fish for radionuclides. The system is housed in Anchorage. The FDA continues to analyze the results, but now the samples are tested in state.
The idea is that in the unfortunate event that there's another incident like Fukushima, that FDA would be able to deploy these instruments to other states so that they could get some real-time monitoring data instead of kind of scrambling after the fact and trying to coordinate these sampling efforts like we have.
Brewer says they will continue to test Alaska seafood specifically for Fukushima-related radiation for at least one more year. None has been detected since testing began. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Monday announced its recovery plan for threatened polar bears, but critics say it doesn't go far enough. Polar bears in 2008 were declared threatened under the Endangered Species Act because of the loss of their primary habitat, sea ice, brought on by climate warming. Polar bears use sea ice for hunting seals. Climate models project that rising temperatures will continue to diminish summer sea ice. The recovery plan calls for reduced greenhouse gas emissions, but requires no direct action for that to happen. The plan says reducing greenhouse gas will require global action. Shane Wolf of the Center for Biological Diversity calls the plan toothless. She says the plan acknowledges the primary problem, but fails to put the solution in the recovery strategy. A group of Ketchikan Good Samaritans banded together last week to help a humpback whale that had become entangled in a barge anchor cable off Prince of Wales Island. Oscar Hopps of Alaska Commercial Divers says the whale was discovered by Olsen Marine crew members on Wednesday.
Apparently what had happened is the humpback whale had been feeding in the Nutqua Inlet for some time. There's a lot of krill around there. And he was spent bubble feeding when he came up and had bit down on this inch and a quarter cable that was going to a 7,000-pound anchor.
The whale must have spun, Hopps says, because the cable wrapped around the top half of its head. Hopps estimates the whale had been tangled for a few days before it was discovered. Rescuers initially thought someone would have to dive down to remove the cable from the anchor, but Hopps says they were able to use the cable to slowly coax the whale to the surface next to the dive boat.
We were able to get a hold of the cable from underneath the whale and cut it, and then from a small boat, we were able to slowly unwind the cable from itself. And then using a system of pulleys, we just kind of slowly pulled the cable off the whale.
Hopps says the whale suffered minor wounds. According to the NOAA Fisheries website, entanglements are one of the leading causes of whale deaths. The agency has produced a podcast giving tips on how to disentangle a whale, along with warnings about the potential danger of getting close to such a large animal. In John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country, Arliss Sterjalowski stands in a field of berries with a view of Denali in the distance, contemplating the potential site of a new state capital. She's one of the dozens of Alaskans who make an appearance in the famous book published 40 years ago. Alaska's Energy Desk is catching up with many of them to celebrate the book's anniversary. At the time, Sterjalewski was on the Capital Site Selection Committee, which McPhee profiles in his book. The idea was to build an entirely new Capitol building and even city outside of Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. Sterjalewski says she relished the opportunity to travel the state, looking at potential sites with the East Coast writer tagging along.
Oh, we looked all over. Helicopters, airplanes. I got to know the state and a lot about the people in the state. It was an exciting time for me. I think John McPhee, when he came here, was really interested in Alaska. And I think that enthusiasm just carried through his time. I was just kind of beginning my political career, so it was a fun time because I was full of enthusiasm in the possibility of Alaska, and I think I transmitted that to John. That was a very special time where sort of, I guess you could say, the sky's the limit, the future's unknown, there's going to be change. But we saw the possibility of lots of money, development, and jobs. I think that with John, I welcomed him because it was somebody to show off a place I just loved. It was a place, of course, for me to also expand my knowledge. But John never let it be known that he was East Coast. He was very much into the whole experience here. Not many people get that opportunity to see as much of Alaska and to meet as many people as we were exposed to on that time that John was here.
Arlis Sterjalewski is a former state senator. She is featured in John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country, which was published 40 years ago. Alaska's Energy Desk is celebrating the anniversary of the book with a series of interviews, stories, and public forums this month.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Four mariners were rescued from their stricken fishing vessel in the Gulf of Alaska on Friday in a mission coordinated by Air Station Kodiak and executed by Air Station Sitka. The trawler Lady Gudney reported fuel problems about 230 miles southeast of Kodiak on Thursday. By Friday, the boat was adrift in high winds and heavy seas. Commander Mo Murphy, operations officer at Air Station Sitka, says his unit decided to be proactive about a possible rescue of the Lady Gudney's crew.
When we heard they were in trouble, we pre-positioned one of our aircraft in Cordova, in anticipation of having to respond.
Cordova was about 200 miles north of the Lady Gudney's position. The Coast Guard air station there is manned in summertime by personnel from Kodiak, but it's not usually manned at all in winter. But with winds clocking at around 50 miles per hour out of the north, Cordova proved to be the ideal location for the air station Sitka helicopter to launch on Friday morning.
The seas were 20-foot seas with occasional 30-footers, and so anytime you're over a boat that's moving that much, it's going to get a little sporty for the basket and anybody that's in the basket or trying to go down and help folks out. So yes, it was close to our limitations, both for distance. We ended up being about 235 miles away from Cordova. The crew only had about 30 minutes on scene before they had to return to base for fuel.
The Air Station Sitka helicopter successfully hoisted all four crew members of the Lady Gudney and flew them across the Gulf to Kodiak, where they were reported to be in good health. 2016 was the warmest year in Alaska since the National Weather Service began keeping records in the state more than a century ago. Two Weather Service climate specialists say that's mainly because of extraordinarily warm ocean water, which in turn helped generate above normal precipitation, especially in the interior. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The sun hasn't risen in Utqiagvik since mid-November, but that didn't keep the temperature from rising on New Year's Day to above freezing. The high temperature in Alaska's northernmost city, formerly known as Barrow, hit 36 degrees Fahrenheit on January 1st, reflecting, in a way, the extraordinarily warm year that had just ended.
2016, over much of Alaska, goes down as the warmest year of record.
Rick Toman is the climate science and services manager at the Fairbanks National Weather Service office.
Equally impressive, or maybe more impressive to me, is the persistence of the warmth.
That's a reference to the frequent above normal temperatures that were recorded by weather stations around the state throughout the year.
Virtually everywhere in Alaska, 70% or more of the days during the year were warmer than normal. And in coastal Alaska, in general, 80% or more of the days warmer than normal. That's really just phenomenal persistence of mild weather.
Anchorage climatologist Brian Brettschneider says the warm days just kept coming day after day, with no appreciable cold snap during the winter and relatively few days of what until recently would be considered normal chilly winter weather.
At one point statewide, we were above normal for 218 consecutive days. I mean, that's just unheard of.
Brett Schneider says 2016 blew past the previous record-setting warm year of 2015, which held the title for only about a year after it had surpassed 2014.
The last 3 years have been the three warmest on record in Alaska, and 2016 was far and away warmer than either of the last 2 years. It's the overarching story of 2016 is the unrelenting warmth.
The National Weather Service says the warmth last winter was fueled largely by warm ocean water generated by El Nino and boosted by a separate phenomenon called the blob, a term scientists use to describe an amorphous area of unusually warm water in the northern Pacific. Toman says those two factors likely were the main reasons for numerous record warm days along the coast.
In coastal Alaska, in general, 80% or more of the days warmer than normal. That's really just phenomenal persistence of mild weather.
Brett Schneider says the lack of any appreciable sea ice contributed to the warm temperatures. They included a record high in Klawak near the end of March of 71 degrees. The Weather Service says the unusually warm weather was followed by a warm spring, which contributed to a very early snowmelt, river breakup, and greenup. Warm air can carry more moisture than cool air, and Brett Schneider says that was demonstrated by the amount of precipitation that fell around the state in 2016, especially in the interior.
Fairbanks had 150% of their normal annual precipitation. It was an extremely wet year in Fairbanks. The normal precipitation for Fairbanks is about 10 inches.
That made 2016 the second wettest year on record for Fairbanks, but Brett Schneider says some areas, like the eastern Gulf of Alaska around Yakutat and parts of the southeastern panhandle, were relatively dry. Statewide, the Weather Service says it was the 10th wettest year on record. Brett Schneider predicts 2017 won't be quite as warm nor wet, but he expects it will be once again a warmer and wetter than normal year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The world of Narnia has come to the Kodiak stage. San Francisco-based actor Stephanie Ann Foster adapted one of the novels in C.S. Lewis's famous series, and it debuted in Kodiak last week. Two actors portray all the characters. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche talked with the duo.
This story's about a boy.
And a girl. And they lived in London in the year 1900.
When the houses were so crammed together they had to show walls.
And Sherlock Holmes still lived in Baker Street.
Foster and her co-actor, local teacher Matt Freeman, read a few lines from The Magician's Nephew. It was published after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but Freeman says it's a prequel.
This one's not as well known for some reason because probably that prequel nature that it has, mm-hmm. but it's really the origin story of Narnia. There's a creation scene, and how these kids from London stumble into it is fascinating.
And when we do that scene, our show is very interactive. There are lots of places where the kids have to scream or do various things. And when we do that scene, they all have to sing. It can be very touching or very silly based on the environment.
Foster and Freeman met at Hollins University, where they were enrolled in the children's literature program, and it wasn't until later that they paired up on the Narnia novels. They are performing the play themselves in what's called a two-hander, a two-man play. They say it's all in the voices and their physicality. Freeman provides one of the main characters as an example.
Diggory, I figure, is about 10, 11, mm-hmm. a young boy, and so you're a little more loose-limbed, a little more energy of youth, I would say. Later on, I'm Aslan, and we have him walk very stately. He's not going to be anxious or jittery. It's very smooth,
very regal,
and stately.
Foster says they also distinguish between characters' class using accents.
So Polly seems to be more upper class. She spends a lot of her time alone at home reading, and she keeps things nice and tidy and clean. So we play her a bit posh, and she knows the right way to do things, and she's very specific in the way she pronounces things.
Foster says she chose to adapt The Magician's Nephew because she has a love for the series, and Freeman helped her work out some of the challenges she faced along the way.
The material is both precious and in some ways dated. So there are some things taken for granted. For example, Polly, as the girl character, isn't in school, and there's no explanation given for that. And Polly, as the female in the play, doesn't know how to swim, and there's no explanation given for that. So we tried to just be a little bit sensitive to that by adding really tiny, unobtrusive explanations into the text. When he says, "Can you swim?" instead of saying, "No," Polly says, "We weren't allowed."
She says she tried to empower the female character without changing Lewis's vision. While Kodiak is the opening tour for the adaptation, Foster says the next step is to submit the script for publication. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Josh Edge and Annie Fite in Anchorage, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.